After a while, the coat of clean white paint on the Geoffrey Curtin house made a definite compromise with the suns of many Julys and showed its good faith by turning grey. It scaled. Huge peelings of very brittle old paint leaned over backward like aged men practicing grotesque gymnastics and finally dropped to a mouldy death in the overgrown grass beneath. The paint on the front pillars became streaky. The white ball was knocked off the left-hand doorpost. The green blinds darkened, then lost all pretense of colour. It began to be a house that was avoided by the tender-minded. Some church bought a lot diagonally opposite for a graveyard, and this combined with the place where Mrs. Curtin stays with that living corpse was enough to throw a ghostly aura over that quarter of the road. Not that she was left alone. Men and women came to see her, met her downtown where she went to do her marketing, brought her home in their cars, and came in for a moment to talk and to rest in the glamour that still played in her smile. But men who did not know her no longer followed her with admiring glances in the street. A diaphanous veil had come down over her beauty, destroying its vividness, yet bringing neither wrinkles nor fat. She acquired a character in the village. A group of little stories were told of her. How, when the country was frozen over one winter so that no wagons or automobiles could travel, she taught herself to skate so that she could make quick time to the grocer and druggist and not leave Geoffrey alone for long. It was said that every night since his paralysis, she slept in a small bed beside his bed, holding his hand. Geoffrey Curtin was spoken of as though he were already dead. As the years dropped by, those who had known him died or moved away. There were but half a dozen of the old crowd who had drunk cocktails together, called each other's wives by their first names, and thought that Geoff was about the wittiest and most talented fellow that Marlowe had ever known. Now, to the casual visitor, he was merely the reason that Mrs. Curtin excused herself sometimes and hurried upstairs. He was a groan or a sharp cry borne to the silent parlour on the heavy air of a Sunday afternoon. He could not move. He was stone blind, dumb, and totally unconscious. All day he lay in his bed, except for a shift to his wheelchair every morning while she straightened the room. His paralysis was creeping slowly toward his heart. At first, for the first year, Roxanne had received the faintest answering pressure sometimes when she held his hand. Then it had gone, ceased one evening, and never came back. And through two nights, Roxanne lay wide-eyed, staring into the dark and wondering what had gone. What fraction of his soul had taken flight? What last grain of comprehension those shattered, broken nerves still carried to the brain. After that hope died, had it not been for her unceasing care, the last spark would have gone long before. Every morning she shaved and bathed him, shifted him with her own hands from bed to chair and back to bed. She was in his room constantly, bearing medicine, straightening a pillow, talking to him, almost as one talks to a nearly human dog, without hope of response or appreciation, but with the dim persuasion of habit, a prayer when faith has gone. Not a few people, one celebrated nerve specialist among them, gave her a plain impression that it was futile to exercise so much care, that if Geoffrey had been conscious, he would have wished to die, that if his spirit were hovering in some wider air, it would agree to no such sacrifice from her. It would fret only for the prison of its body to give it full release. "But you see," she replied, shaking her head gently, "when I married Geoffrey, it was until I ceased to love him."
"But," was protested in effect,
You can't love that. I can love what it once was. What else is there for me to do? The specialist shrugged his shoulders and went away to say that Mrs. Curtin was a remarkable woman and just about as sweet as an angel. But, he added, it was a terrible pity. There must be some man, or a dozen, just crazy to take care of her. Casually, there were. Here and there, someone began in hope and ended in reverence. There was no love in the woman except, strangely enough, for life, for the people in the world. From the tramp to whom she gave food she could ill afford, to the butcher who sold her a cheap cut of steak across the meaty board. The other phase was sealed up somewhere in that expressionless mummy who lay with his face turned ever toward the light, as mechanically as a compass needle, and waited dumbly for the last wave to wash over his heart. After 11 years, he died. In the middle of a May night, when the scent of the syringa hung upon the windowsill and a breeze wafted in the shrillings of the frogs and cicadas outside, Roxanne awoke at 2 and realized with a start she was alone in the house at last.